From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The Senate is preparing for its second impeachment trial of President Trump, and it could begin almost exactly a year after his first, which, as we know, ended in an acquittal. One key difference this time is that President Trump will no longer be in office, and that raises some legal questions. That's why we're going to bring in Stephen Vladeck. He's from the University of Texas Law School. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And, you know, we've been asking some of these same questions to people like you over the past few days because this has never happened before. And frankly, a lot of it is unclear. What's your interpretation? Does the Constitution say an impeachment trial can happen after a president leaves office?
So it doesn't say so in so many words, but it also doesn't say it can't. And I think the way the Constitution is written and the historical practice under it both, I think, make pretty clear that it can happen. So as I think folks are learning, one of the things the Senate has the power to do if it convicts the person who's tried is to disqualify them from holding future office. So this is not just about removing someone from an office they already have. There's also the separate and distinct question of whether the Senate actually is going to prevent this person from continuing to hold office in the future. And we have historical examples. So the very, very first impeachment of Senator William Blount in the 1790s, the Senate proceeded with the trial, even though it had already expelled Blount from the Senate. In 1876, the House impeached, the Senate tried. Former Secretary of War William Belknap, who resigned literally moments before the House impeached him. And they both formally concluded that they had the power to try and remove, if necessary, former officials. So, you know, I think both the way the Constitution's written and the historical practice support the power of the Senate to do this starting next week.
But it has never been a president before, so you don't imagine that would cause any complications?
Well, I mean, it's certainly never been a president before. Of course, we've also never had a president who was impeached twice. I don't think the fact that it's the president causes any complications with regard to whether the Senate can do it at all. I think the only complication that arises from the fact that it's the president is who presides. So the Constitution says that in cases of impeachment against the president, the Chief Justice is supposed to preside as opposed to the president of the Senate. Well, is that this case? You know, I think that's actually one of the questions this raises. But to sort of step back for a second, the uncertainty over who presides, I think, is really outweighed by the long-standing practice and the long-time understanding that the House and the Senate have had that just because you resign or just because your term ends doesn't mean that you can therefore escape the consequences, including here the potential disqualification from future office.
Okay, let's get into that. There is a separate vote, as you say, on whether to prevent President Trump from ever holding office again. Does he have to be convicted first for that second vote to happen?
Yeah, so the Senate's rules say yes, and I think that's probably right. So Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, when it talks about how the Senate is actually supposed to conduct an impeachment trial, refers to the removal and disqualification of the officer as opposed to the removal or the disqualification of the officer. Also, the Constitution requires that the first vote, the conviction, be by two-thirds of the members present, whereas the disqualification vote under the Senate's rules only requires a majority. So, you know, I think the way this is supposed to work, and I think the way this will work, is the Senate will conduct a trial, it will vote at the end of it, and if in fact two-thirds of the members present conclude that President Trump is guilty of the article that the House has impeached him on, then they'll move on to a vote over disqualification. I got to say, Peter, I mean, if there's two-thirds of a majority to hold that he should be convicted, I have to think there will also be at least a, you know, ordinary majority to hold that he should therefore be disqualified from seeking future office. But, you know, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
Sure. I mean, that does make sense. And I do just want to be clear here. So if he's acquitted in that first vote, the question about whether or not he can ever hold office again is kind of moot because they're not going to get there. Now, if senators vote to bar President Trump from holding office, is there a way that the president could challenge that? Could it end up in the courts?
I don't think it could end up in the courts directly. So, you know, the Supreme Court in 1993, in a case ironically called Nixon versus United States, but not about President Nixon, about a judge, held that in general, challenges to how the House and the Senate conduct impeachment proceedings are not for the courts to decide. They're not justiciable. They're committed by the Constitution to resolution of the political branches. So I don't think the president would be able to sue right away. I think the trickier thing would be suppose that the Senate votes to disqualify President Trump, and in three and a half years, he nevertheless tries to run for office again. I think that probably would produce litigation either because a state blocks him and he sues, or because a state allows him to run and then some other voters sue. So this may not be the end of the matter from a litigation perspective. I just don't anticipate that we would see that litigation overnight.
I hope you can answer this next question in about 30 seconds. The House did not call witnesses for this impeachment. It was a fast process, and in fact, some Republicans complained about that. What do you expect in the Senate trial? Do you expect witnesses, new evidence?
I doubt it. And I think, you know, that's partly because the Republicans themselves set the precedent last year in President Trump's first trial that they're not going to go out of their way to expand the record from what the House based it on.
Stephen Vladeck, professor at the University of Texas School of Law. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, meanwhile, public health officials report that more than 3,800 Americans died of COVID-19 yesterday, and there were more than 230,000 new cases of the disease. Wednesday was the ninth straight day with more than 200,000 new infections. And researchers in Ohio say they've discovered two new strains of the virus, which appear to have originated here in the U.S. Let's bring in Dr. Lena Wen. She's a professor of public health at George Washington University and an emergency physician. Dr. Wen, welcome.
Thank you. Great to join you.
So yesterday's alarming death toll was actually a slight downtick from the record we set on Tuesday, more than 4,300. We are not flattening the curve here. And a model from the University of Washington is forecasting 115,000 deaths in January, which would shatter the record that we just set last month. So how seriously should we take that? I mean, the model is not a crystal ball, but is it nevertheless alarming?
Very much so. I mean, we are setting records in hospitalizations every day. And I think that this is all occurring as pandemic fatigue is setting in across the country. We've become numb to these numbers in a way that we really cannot. And there is this false hope, I think, that vaccines are what's going to get us through this time. I do think that vaccines are a total game changer, that they will get us through this pandemic. But what's going to get us through the surge right now is not vaccines. It is all of us following these basic public health guidance of masking, physical distancing, very critically avoiding indoor gatherings. Our hospitals are overwhelmed. They are the last line of defense. The first line of defense that we have is our own actions in our communities, in our homes.
So to that end, I mean, if the vaccine is not the silver bullet, I mean, we have a new president coming in less than a week. Is there something that the Biden administration can do right from the outset to change the trajectory here?
It's going to be very challenging, to be honest, because we know that it's individuals' behaviors that are determining what's happening with the projections. The projections are not a weather forecast. They're not static. It's not like a hurricane is coming towards us no matter what we do. Actually, we can change that trajectory, but we need people to do their part. And I hope that President-elect Biden is going to focus on that critical element of avoiding indoor gatherings. He has already talked a lot about masking, but there is a magical thinking that many people have. That we're seeing this gathering of extended family and friends that's driving this latest surge. But I also do hope that President-elect Biden will really focus on vaccine rollout as well. Because if we as a country gather around that as our goal and really focus on a wartime effort to get vaccines out, I think that's also going to galvanize us and hopefully refocus our attention on doing what we can now while waiting for vaccines to come.
Dr. Wen, I want to ask you about the two new strains that I mentioned at the top. We've already talked a lot about the UK variant, which we know is here in the US, but now we've got these two other ones that researchers in Ohio have found. I mean, how worried should we be? And critically, do we know whether vaccines are effective against these variants?
We should be very worried about these new strains. This virus is constantly mutating. That we know, that's what viruses do. But there appear to be new strains that make this virus even more susceptible, even more transmissible and contagious. And this is already an extremely contagious virus. And so we could really be facing strains from either their homegrown strains here or strains that are coming from other parts of the world that are even more contagious and could overwhelm our healthcare system even more. So I'm very concerned. And I think also this really speaks to lack of surveillance and investment in testing that we've had all along. There's no reason for us to believe at the moment that the vaccines are not going to be effective against these new strains, but that's something that we should be watching because at this point, it's a race against time.
Well, as you talk about new strains maybe coming in from other countries, the CDC seems concerned about that because there is now a new requirement for airline passengers to show proof of a negative test before boarding international flights. And this includes Americans coming back into the country. Could start as soon as January 26th. In the moment we have left, what's your thought on that strategy?
I think it's really important. I actually think that we should go much further than that. We should be requiring testing before domestic flights too, because you will be able to identify some individuals who are asymptomatic and don't know it and would not otherwise be traveling. They don't know that they are actually carriers for coronavirus. Testing alone is not sufficient. It should also be combined with quarantining and other strategies. However, having more frequent testing wherever it is that people are is a major step in the right direction, and one that I hope the president-elect is also going to be focusing on.
All right. We've been speaking with ER doctor and George Washington University professor of public health, Dr. Lena Wen. Dr. Wen, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court has delivered its first ruling on an abortion case since Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court in October. The decision reinstates a federal requirement that women who want to use a pill to end a pregnancy in the first 10 weeks must pick it up in person at a hospital or a clinic. That rule was temporarily suspended in July after the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists sued. They argued the restrictions put women at risk during the pandemic. Julia Kay is an attorney with the ACLU, which is representing that group of doctors, and she joins us now. Julia, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be on the show.
The federal rule requires women to go in person to a hospital or to a clinic to get this abortion pill. It does require a prescription, by the way. What's the effect of the ruling by the Supreme Court to uphold it?
Well, what this means is that the government is forcing patients again to needlessly risk contracting a life-threatening disease as a condition of obtaining an abortion. The serious viral risks associated with travel during the pandemic are exactly why the government has suspended in-person requirements during the public health emergency for other, far less safe drugs, including opioids like fentanyl.
Aren't you making a short-term argument, though? It sounds to me like you're saying when this pandemic is over, sure, it's fine if the rule goes back into effect.
Well, in this case, we are narrowly focused on the particular harms that the in-person requirements impose during the COVID-19 pandemic. But actually, the ACLU has other pre-pandemic litigation challenging the FDA's entire package of outdated, medically unjustified, and harmful restrictions on medication abortion.
Well, the court's liberal justice dissented. Chief Justice John Roberts, on the conservative side here, said the decision had nothing to do with whether the rule put an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion, but instead was simply deferring to experts. So in other words, the FDA had recommended the in-person pickup, and the lower court was wrong to overrule them because the FDA are the experts. Does that argument work for you?
The Chief Justice's concurrence is exactly backwards. As the dissent emphasized, this was not a reasoned judgment of public health officials grappling with the pandemic. It is undisputed that the FDA never even considered the impact of these in-person requirements during the public health emergency. They have not revisited these restrictions in years, and they ignored urgent requests from leading medical authorities, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, to take a close look at the harm and dangers that the in-person pill pickup requirement is causing during the pandemic. They refuse to do so.
Well, I know you're focusing on the pandemic here, but big picture, the question could be about a woman's access to this form of abortion. And the Trump administration, in its brief, said the rules impose no obstacle whatsoever to other commonly used and generally accepted methods of abortion and do not create a substantial obstacle to abortion. Your response to that?
That is simply wrong. Even under normal circumstances, the FDA's outdated package of restrictions on medication abortion are uniformly opposed by the nation's leading medical authorities, including the American Medical Association, because they provide zero safety benefit while burdening patients' access to abortion care. Let's be clear that the harm here is particularly grave for communities of color, who comprise the majority of impacted patients and who are dying from COVID-19 at vastly higher rates.
Is this all moot, this rule? Because there is a new administration on its way in. I mean, what do you expect Joe Biden to do about this? Anything?
We certainly hope that the Biden administration will issue guidance making clear that it will not enforce these dangerous in-person requirements during the public health emergency. The Biden administration has repeatedly said that they will follow the science in crafting policies relating to COVID-19. And in this case, all of the evidence shows that these restrictions provide no benefit at all while seriously endangering patients. So what we are calling for them to do is call for a comprehensive reevaluation of the FDA's restrictions on medication abortion to ensure that patients' access here is dictated by evidence and not politics.
Well, as I said, this is the first abortion decision since Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court. There's now a 6-3 conservative majority. And look ahead, at least 16 states are proposing laws that would restrict, ban, limit, or impose waiting periods on abortion. What do you predict is ahead using this as a guidepost, this ruling?
The court's decision in this case sends a chilling signal about the future of the right to abortion. The only possible explanation for what the court did here is to make it as difficult as possible for people to get an abortion in this country when they need one. So I think there is no doubt that Roe v. Wade hangs by a thread.
ACLU attorney Julia Kay talking about the Supreme Court's decision upholding a rule that says women must go in person to a hospital or to a clinic to pick up a pill to end pregnancy. Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Healthcare workers have put their lives in danger treating COVID-19 patients throughout the pandemic, but there's also been an unexpected consequence for some of the young physicians working long hours in the country's emergency rooms this year. Graduating emergency medicine residents are struggling to find full-time jobs. Let's bring in Dr. Mark Rosenberg, chair of emergency medicine at St. Joseph's Health in Paterson, New Jersey. He's also the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So, Dr. Rosenberg, we know that emergency medicine residencies are among the most competitive to get into, and that the residents who graduate often have their pick of jobs. So explain what's going on.
This is a perfect storm, so to speak. The emergency departments across the country are really the front door of the hospital. That's where people come in who require surgery, who have emergencies, and the like. The population, everybody, for right good reasons, were afraid to go to emergency departments. And as a result, we saw this decrease in volume, approximately 20%. We've also had some very unique changes in society. For a while, people weren't driving and car accidents were down. And many of the traditional emergencies, heart attacks, strokes, people would stay at home rather than risk going to the emergency departments. Hospitals closed same-day surgery to make room for all the COVID patients. As a result, a very large decrease in revenue coming into the hospitals. So the hospitals are looking to save money and provide great care, but save money in every way they can.
So the predicament makes sense when you explain it that way, although it is kind of counterintuitive. And we've all seen that stark statistic from the American Hospital Association that U.S. hospitals lost an estimated $50 billion a month between March and June. And as you mentioned, I mean, we're talking about a large share, a quarter, maybe a fifth of residents who are affected, some saying that they had job offers rescinded. What are you hearing from residents and from employers?
You're really stating the truth. And most emergency departments across the country are hospital-based. They are employed or contracted by the hospital. So the hospital also wants to decrease the number of people who they can to deal with the financial stress. So as a result, many emergency physicians, residents alike, have had their jobs rescinded, their contracts terminated or not signed. Many physicians, not just residents, have had as many as 30% of their hours cut, which means a 30% pay decrease for them. My biggest concern for residents is many have large loans to go through residency.
I think you're hitting a really important point here, because the whole reason that these medical students are willing to take on $200,000, $300,000 worth of debt is with the expectation that they will be able to land a high-paying job and pay those debts off very quickly. So what does it mean for your industry if they're not necessarily able to do that?
Well, you hit a key factor here. Rhetorically asking this question, Would you go into a specialty where a job was not guaranteed or less secure than it was before? Or possibly you would have to work in an area of the country that's very rural or not an area that you wanted to work in. So I anticipate that future classes of emergency medicine may have a pullback in the interest that many medical students and new grads would want to work in emergency medicine. As you said, it's one of the most competitive residency programs, and hopefully we will have jobs for some of these great residents that are coming out of this. What we don't know is, will there be a reversal in some of these numbers? Will patients come back to emergency departments? Did telehealth cannibalize a lot of ED volume? Did other alternative ways of providing care change it? Is that 20% number reversible? Will the volume go up? And if I could add one comment, the emergency departments are uniquely specialized in providing unscheduled acute care, 24/7, 365. And the public has always valued that. Whenever they have a concern, they come to the nation's emergency departments. It's my feeling things will reverse, and we will see a resurgence of emergency department patients. But we have not yet. So the financial paradigm has shifted, and hence we're having this conversation.
Well, it's sort of a funny thing in a way, because it's good in some ways that the demand for emergency medical services has gone down. But as you point out, some of that may be artificial in the sense that folks still need the care and perhaps are not seeking the care that they need. So for that, we hope that folks will be able to get back into the emergency rooms when they need it and that the doctors will be there. Dr. Mark Rosenberg, president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, thank you so much for talking with us about this job shortage for emergency room doctors.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and stay safe.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
President Trump's standing in the business community is crumbling as many corporations and longtime business partners abandon him following last week's riot at the Capitol. New York City now says it's ending its multi-million dollar contracts with the Trump Organization. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi is here. Hi, Ali.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. So Eric Trump, the president's son and the executive vice president of the Trump Organization, is not happy about this decision to terminate the contracts. It includes the Central Park Carousel, two ice skating rinks, and a golf course in the Bronx. Ali, in the scheme of things, it seems small, but it certainly is symbolic.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people forget that, you know, Donald Trump was a big shot in New York. He was a real estate heavy hitter. He's got skating rinks, and as you say, in Central Park, the Carousel, the Ferry's Point Golf Course. They've got about $17 million a year in profits that they get, according to Mayor Bill de Blasio. And he has said that they've got the right to sever these ties because of the violence in Washington. The Trump Organization says otherwise. They've vowed to fight the decision. They say that if the city doesn't pay them $30 million, they're in trouble. And they're calling it political discrimination. But the mayor and people in New York are saying, no, you were involved in what turned out to be deadly riots and the encouragement of them. That's enough to break our contract. It was criminal activity.
You know, he has been criticized for inciting violence before, maybe nothing like this. But so why now? Is this just a convenient time to jump ship as he leaves office?
Well, it's possible, but you know, the Trump name, particularly as it's been associated with brands and business, has suffered. And we've also been in a year of reckoning, whether it's because of the social justice movements or otherwise. A number of companies have decided they don't want to be involved in things that look like they are anti-democratic. See, companies typically donate broadly across the political spectrum. Sometimes it'll be more to Democrats or more to Republicans, depending on the season or the topics at play. But a number of major companies like Coca-Cola says it's going to pause donations from its political action committee. Marriott, the hotel chain, is going to pause donations against those who voted against the certification of the election of Joe Biden. Morgan Stanley, AT&T, across the board, companies have just said we can't be involved in funding politicians who sow this divisiveness.
You know, Ali, the Trump organization was already facing a lot of debt. I think it was $400 million in debt payments are coming due here. What's the financial stakes for Trump and his business empire?
So on one hand, right after the election, Donald Trump was making a lot of money in this effort to fight the election because he kept fundraising and he raised over $250 million. And there were some people who thought the reason he's keeping this going is because he's raising all this money. On the other hand, his single biggest lender, Deutsche Bank, is one of those companies that have said we're not doing further business. So this money that is up for refinancing, Donald Trump's going to face some problem with. He owes more than, you know, the estimates are $300 to $450 million. So this creates a new threat to Donald Trump. I will say this. The events of the last couple of months have indicated that if Donald Trump wants to make money off of, say, a media operation, he might be able to raise that money because he's got so many supporters. But the violence that took place last week was a tipping point for a lot of organizations, including the PGA, which canceled its tournament at the golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey.
Yeah, and I guess another question to ask later is, what's the long-term damage to the brand? We'll see. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The former governor of Michigan pleaded not guilty today to two charges of willful neglect of duty nearly 7 years after lead-contaminated water killed 12 people and sickened many more in Flint. Rick Snyder is one of at least 9 public officials facing criminal charges related to the water crisis that began after the city switched its water supply in 2014. Steve Carmody is a reporter for Michigan Radio. He's been following this. Steve, explain what it all means. Who's been charged? What are they facing?
Well, the governor is facing, as you said, two counts. They're two misdemeanor counts, and that's pretty much the least important charges filed. There are a couple members of former senior state health department officials who are facing 9 counts of involuntary manslaughter. That's tied to the Legionnaire's disease outbreak, which occurred at the same time as the Flint water switch, and some experts believe was caused by the switch in Flint's water. There are also some other people close to the former governor. A man who was his chief fixer is charged with perjury and extortion. Both of those felonies. So there are quite a few charges, and we'll learn more about what the basis for those charges are as these criminal cases continue.
Well, this was such a devastating event for Flint, and they've been dealing with the fallout for years. You've been hearing from residents. Here's Montez Edwards.
They made it harder on people to stay here, and he just go out in the sunset. No, we want justice for what he did.
Sounds like he's not happy with those misdemeanor charges. What else are we hearing?
A lot of people aren't happy with those misdemeanor charges. This has been 7 years in the making since the city's water source was switched by the emergency managers appointed by Governor Snyder to run the city of Flint. And people have been wanting justice. They have wanted someone to have charges brought against them. And they're tired of waiting. And when they see that the governor, who has been their main target of, the person they wanted most to see criminally charged, is only being charged with misdemeanors, they're very disappointed in that.
Well, Snyder's attorney says the charges are part of a politically motivated smear campaign, and this is pretty unusual to have a former governor charged like this. What are the political implications?
Well, this is the first time in the history of the state of Michigan, so we're talking 180 years, since a former governor was charged with crimes connected to when they were in office. So this is a very rare event, obviously, in the state of Michigan. And this is a criminal charge brought against a former Republican governor under a Democrat attorney general. So there have been, you know, allegations raised that this may have been somewhat politically motivated. We'll see how it plays out in court.
Steve Carmody, reporter for Michigan Radio. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let me ask you a question. Have you used an emoji today? Maybe more than one? Those little pixelated characters can help us show emotion, as their name suggests, but they don't always represent the diversity of their users. And changing that isn't easy. Rayouf Al-Humaidi knows all about this. When she was 15, she campaigned to add an emoji depicting a woman wearing a hijab, the head covering donned by many Muslim women. Here she is presenting her case in 2016.
If there are four emojis to represent the four different stages of a mailbox, why on earth isn't there one to represent the 500 million Muslims that wear the headscarf?
Rayouf Al-Humaidi's story is told in the documentary The Emoji Story, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we're so glad to have you, and I know that you proposed the hijab emoji because you couldn't find an emoji that represented you, and not just you. As we heard you point out in that bit of tape, hundreds of millions of Muslim women were left out. So what made you want to do something about that?
For sure. Quite simply, it was just the need to feel represented in a time where, living in Europe, I was witnessing the increased Islamophobia, and I felt that any representation of myself was always misconstrued, misrepresented. So I thought, you know, it's time for a Muslim woman to be a part of the conversation of how do I want to be represented in technology and in the digital space.
And this isn't an easy process, right? Because in the film, we learn that there's actually an official group that sort of recognizes emojis. It's called Unicode. It's a Silicon Valley organization. It decides which new emojis get included every year and then are adopted by companies like Apple, Microsoft, and Google. And you had to actually go and appear in person to argue your case, as if you were going to the Supreme Court or something. I mean, what was that experience like?
It was honestly insane. At that point, I was 15. The most I've ever done in terms of presenting was biology lab reports. So I was definitely taken aback because, like everyone, I would never think that creating an emoji would be such a bureaucratic process. But it really is. It goes through several rounds of approval. But going in was so shocking. I had my dad outside of the door who's like, "Well, you can do it. You're gonna show them that a hijab emoji is needed." And I guess it worked.
It did work. But not only were you sort of standing in judgment of these tech officials at Unicode, of course, you got a lot of media attention for your cause. And so then there's a lot of feedback from the public. And I know you got a lot of support on the one hand, but also fielded some criticism on the other hand. And one that I know you heard a lot was this assertion that you were, sort of representing a repressive culture by campaigning for a hijab wearing emoji. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that?
For sure. At that point, I knew that for me, it was a choice, and it is the case for millions of women, but I don't go into this assuming that that is the case for everyone. But at the same time that I feel empowered in my hijab, and so do millions, I feel like there's a room for compassion for that understanding as well. And I think slamming such an idea as, oh, it's a symbol of oppression, a lot of the times comes from people who have never really engaged in talking with a Muslim woman and are just taking headlines, sensational headlines they see. I never really took it to heart because I know that these rhetorics aren't motivated by actual knowledge of what it's like to be a Muslim woman, but what they're reading and making assumptions about.
You know, one of the things we learn in the film, too, is that for a lot of people, emojis are kind of their own language. They use them in the same way that they use words, and that has drawn attention from actual linguists who are studying this sort of thing. And so in the film, we hear from one of those linguists. His name is Michael Everson, and he's actually contributed several emojis of his own, and he got them approved by Unicode, including one with the middle finger. That was apparently important, but yet he's critical of campaigns like yours. Let's take a listen.
The user community seemed to feel that I need to express myself and this doesn't show me properly, and so it, you know, we should add more things. The problem is that it's impossible to achieve because somebody's always going to be left out.
Somebody's always going to be left out, says Michael Everson. How do you respond to that?
I don't think anyone is going into this saying, oh, I have a freckle on the top left corner of my face, I don't feel represented. No one is going into it like is being assumed. But at the same time, if we're making the argument, oh, no one's going to feel represented, then why are we dedicating spaces to very idle objects? Like I mentioned, the four mailboxes, if we're so impassioned by the fact that, oh, there shouldn't be representation for everyone, then why are we investing space in things that no one uses?
Do you agree with that to any degree, that there maybe are too many emojis, or maybe we should clear out some of the old ones that don't get a lot of use?
I think it's just, you could break it down to what is in our day-to-day, what are the most necessary items to feel represented that, oh, would make sense in the format of a digital space? And in terms of the hijab emoji, the way I've seen it used is in bios of a lot of fashion hijab bloggers or just regular women who wear the hijab, or in context of like telling stories. But I think it's a much more complex sociolinguistic analysis of what's emoji deserves a space and what not. And I don't know if I'm the right person to make an amazing comment on that.
Well, it must be rewarding, though, to see your emoji in use in the years since. Of course, your campaign was successful, and this was several years ago. You're now a student at Stanford University. So I have to ask, what are your plans for when you graduate?
As I ask myself that every single day, so I'm still not sure. Right now, I'm majoring in economics and product design. I think product design was motivated by the fact that I spent, you know, quite a bit of time trying to understand the user experience of the fabric on the hijab would look like as an emoji. So I think that definitely made an impact in my major decision. But in the future, I think I'll still be really interested in technology and social impact. But I'm still uncertain. That's all I know.
Well, if it's any indication, you've got to, maybe you could go to law school because you had such success arguing your case. And congratulations on that. Rayouf Al-Humeidi campaigned for the inclusion of a hijab emoji successfully, and her story is told in The Emoji Story. For more information, go to hereandnow.org. Rayouf, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bianca Smith will make history as the first black woman to coach professional baseball when spring training begins next month. After she wraps up her job as a hitting coach at Carroll University in Wisconsin, she'll start with the Red Sox minor league system in Fort Myers, Florida. Let's talk with her. Bianca Smith, welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And tell me about this job, because hitting a baseball spinning towards you at 100 miles per hour has got to be literally one of the hardest things to do on earth. How do you coach your players to be good hitters?
It is really one of the hardest jobs. It's working mechanics for sure, making sure they have a good hard swing, but it's also being able to make sure that they can see the ball coming in. So working on vision, working on their approach at the plate. And then a lot of it is also mental. It's being kind of a psychologist and making sure mentally they're in the game too.
Well, speaking of inside the head, I have two young girls, and I know that they've never seen a woman in the dugout of a baseball stadium. Probably don't even think there ever could be one. And now here you are, thank goodness, getting this job. Talk about your role as a trailblazer in professional baseball.
Honestly, it's still weird for me to think of, because there have been, you know, women before me. So to me, they're the trailblazers. They're the one who set the stage, and I'm just continuing the act behind them. So yeah, the idea that I'm a trailblazer is certainly not one I thought of, but I mean, if that means more girls, more women are more interested in this game and might want to consider coaching as an opportunity, then even better for it.
I think about another name, Jackie Robinson. April 15th, 1947, he became the first black player in Major League Baseball history. Do you think all these years later that his legacy actually is trickling down to you too?
I don't think I'm anywhere near that. He did so much more, and he had to face so much more than I think I have or ever will. I mean, I'm flattered that people say that, but I just don't think I've had the same challenges and the same obstacles that he has. And I can't see myself on the same level.
So now you're coaching a bunch of guys who probably think they know what they're doing. They're probably pretty confident guys. How do they treat you? How does that go?
I mean, the guys I have now, they treat me like any other coach. I respect them. They respect me. I learn how they learn. It's not me forcing my philosophies on them. I mean, my job is just to make sure that they get what they need to get to where they want to get.
Yeah, I know you've had a lot of jobs along the way, some years under your belt. Director of baseball operations at Case Western Reserve, for one. In that time, though, has anyone doubted you or sidelined you just because of who you are?
I've had a few, not a lot, thankfully. And I've had plenty of people who had my back, even in those few times. You know, there was a high school coach who kind of jokingly said that he could hire me to make sandwiches for his team after I finished grad school. And this was after I listed all of my responsibilities and my qualifications. I've had somebody, they found out I was a hitting coach here at Carroll, and their first response was, oh, well, that team's going to lose. I mean, yeah, it's definitely happened. But like I said, I've had a lot of people who had my back. And again, it's, I mean, it's about the players. The players trust me. What other people say, like, that doesn't really affect how I do my job.
There is something going on in baseball, though. I wonder what you make of it, the change that's happening in your sport. Because in November, this was just one more case, the Marlins named Kim Ng to be the first female general manager in Major League history. What do you think of this moment that we're in?
I think it just goes to show that while playing experience is certainly valuable, it's not the only tool you need. And there's so many people out there who can provide value to teams, who can help teams win. And I think we're really starting to see that now. And the game is opening up for so many other people.
Got to be tough, though, because there probably aren't that many opportunities at all for girls and young women to play the sport of baseball. Now, of course, softball is something that they have access to and can play if they want to through college. But baseball is a different story. So how do you solve that problem?
We're getting there. I know Justine Siegel, who actually was the first woman to coach professional baseball. Now, she started up her foundation, Baseball for All, chance for girls to get a chance to play baseball and not just softball. At this point, I think it's a matter of just getting the word out, letting girls know that this is an opportunity, because yes, girls usually get pushed to softball and baseball is not really a thought for them. So now showing them that there's a chance for you to play, it's going to keep opening doors for girls and women in this game.
Okay, Bianca Smith, hope springs eternal. Thank God for baseball in these times we live in. How are the Red Sox going to do this year? Make a prediction for us.
That's hard. I was never very good at overall predictions because the game is the season's so long.
I thought you were going to say World Series champions.
I think there's always a chance. So ask me once I get to know the players and I get to know the coaches and I get to see what the roster looks like. Then you can ask me what I think.
You know, we would like to check in as the season goes on. And we're a long way from October. But first things first, congratulations on your new job. Bianca Smith, new coach for the Red Sox minor league team in Florida and the first Black woman coach in professional baseball. Thanks again. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.